What's going on, everybody? Welcome to our first ever episode of Around the World. I'm Dylan, and I'm here with Drags, and we are starting off with an awesome guest today. A guy we know really well, but also a guy that has seen a lot that the soccer world has to offer. We're going to be bringing guests to you from all around the world and all different walks of the soccer life every week, and we're super pumped to start with Victor Benedictsson. Victor was a youth national team player for Iceland, his native country. He also played professionally for IA and Stord, teams in Iceland and Norway that are very prominent in their countries. And now he is with us at Villanova University going into his senior year, a key component of last year's team. Welcome, Victor. How are you doing?
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. All right. Well, Vic, let's start it off. So talk to us initially just about like the beginning of your soccer career, how you got into it when you were younger, and start us off at the beginning.
So yeah, like my interest, like from when I was 1 year old of kicking the ball was intense. Like you had the ball in the house and I broke every single vase you had in the house. But I lived in England when I was about 4 years old, which is of course like the Mecca of soccer in the world. And I went to my first Premier League game there when I was four. And that was like the time when like the love for soccer really got going. And then I moved to Iceland and I started practicing there at 4 years old, in a fisherman town of 300 people.
Dude, that's awesome.
So I was like four and I was practicing with like 9 year olds because there were like three kids in a class in the soccer team. So
that's super interesting. You definitely don't see that in America too often. Yeah. So what, so kind of going off that same question, but so obviously you're introduced to soccer at a super, super young age. You fell in love with it really early, but what kind of made you take soccer seriously and kind of what club kind of kickstarted you in that?
So after I just lived for 1 year in this fisherman town in Iceland there. And then I moved to the city and I moved to Hafnarfjörður, which is like 15 minutes from the capital. And it's one of the bigger towns in Iceland. And it was at that point that I like really got introduced to like a big club in a sense, like a top division, winning the league type of club. So I went there and I got to practice there, and just right that week, I got into like the better, like skilled, or like you have it skill based in Iceland. So like you play based on how good you are. And I just dropped straight into the good group. And I never looked back after that, because like joining a big club in a sense for me at that time, it was just, this was a part of my daily routine and a part of my life, really. I went to school and I went to practice, and practice was like straight when I was like 6 years old. It was like a job for me in a sense. So yeah, that's how it like, that's how it became like more serious. Mm-hmm. Because like we start going on like tournaments and stuff when we're like seven. Mm-hmm. And that as a 7 year old kid, you're like, oh wow, this is like the World Cup for me, you know. Yeah. No matter how small the tournament is.
No, like one.
Yeah.
No, that I mean I remember I felt the same way when I was 7 years old. But Vic, you played for a bunch of teams. I'm not gonna butcher the pronunciation of all these teams that you've played for in Iceland and Norway. But walk us through what your career has kind of looked like all the way up to coming over here to Nova, as well as your international experience.
So if I go, like, try to make it a little bit short in a sense, since I could talk about this forever, is I started off there in a fisherman town with the UMFG Grundafjörður. UMFG, let's call it that. Went to FH, and it was at FH that I was called up to the national team for the first time. So I was called up when I was 15 for the under 17 national team. And we played at that time great teams. We went into the group stage for the qualifiers for the Euros, and then it's like in the Euro qualifiers in the unders. It's you do the qualifiers. If you go through, you go to another group stage. So we got into that group stage. It was fun and everything. That was there, and that is the same time I started practicing with the first team there at 15. And then after practicing there, and I played 3 years with the under 20 team in FPAU, my team there, I thought I have to get a new challenge, really. So that's when I went on loan to HK in the second highest division in Iceland. And that was like my first real season in the first team soccer. Went well. Like, just very well. And so my coach that was at HK, he went to another club called IA. And after my loan, I went back to FH, and was my old coach from HK, he brought me over to IA with him.
Gotcha.
And we played in the second highest division there also. And at that time, around that time, a little bit before, that was when the under 19 thing started for me with the national team under 19. That was a lot of fun also. Nice experience. Played with IA. We won the league, second highest division.
Wow.
After that season, I'm thinking what to do. Because I'm, 19 at the time. And I'm thinking, like, should I stay? And I knew they were bringing two other players in my position in. So I was like, am I going to stay and maybe get less playing time than I want? Or should I go on loan? Or what am I supposed to do? And that is when a friend of mine calls me who helps players go to the States for college. He calls me up and tells me about the showcase game. I try that out. I'm not thinking about it a lot, though. And end up actually taking the chance when Noah came knocking. And that is the reason I went to Norway, really, because I knew the coach in Norway, and he told me, hey, you can only play for 3 months before you go to the States, so why don't you come here? It's a longer season than in Iceland. You get more games and you stay in shape. So that's when I went to Norway for like half a year, and the States has been ever since. In between, if you want to discuss that, like, I have practiced and played games with Norwich City in England, with IFK Gothenburg in Sweden. And then recently, like during the summer breaks here, I've been practicing with Trollhättan and Jönköping in Sweden, which are like second highest, third highest division, Sweden.
Yeah.
They jump up and down all the time. So yeah, that's, even though it was a long segment here, that was the short version of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's awesome. One thing before, because we definitely want to delve into a lot about your transition to American soccer. But before that, one thing that I was thinking about was obviously just playing with you and knowing you, like, and when you came to Villanova, you're a defensive-minded guy. But I remember you telling me, just through your stories, that, you know, you used to play a little bit of six for your clubs, and then you would transition to center back, especially like for the national team. So how would you kind of balance that? Like, what would kind of go through your mind, and how did you make that transition? It seemed like pretty seamlessly between both.
So the funniest thing is, I have on record national team games in every position except for fullback or like an outside back and a goalkeeper. That's the only positions I've not played the national team game. So like, I was a striker for a long time. Yeah. And in under-20s, my first year in under-20s, I was a striker. Scored 17 goals in 21 games, 11 with headers, so it Big tells time. You a lot, maybe. and then I was brought back to the into a 10 position, attacking mid. And then my last year in the under-20s, I was brought back to like a center back.
Yeah.
But before under-20s, I was always a six, like always. And it was actually like at that time, I was brought up to the under-19s national team. I was a six for the under-19s national team, but I was a center back or a striker for the under-20s. So like I've always had these many positions. And it became a dilemma because we thought like, if I'm not focusing on one position, I might get like average in every position, but not like good in any. But I think all of that helped with the transition from going from a six to a center back, because and the way I play a six is kind of like a extra center back, really.
Right,
it's right. Like a very old school six. So yeah, that transition went smooth also because of Iceland, really. It's our style of play with the national team, for example. Like, we like to defend. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care if I have the ball 30% of the game. If you defend well and then counterattack, that's what they want to do. So
yeah,
it was just something that no matter the position, you always were focused on the defensive part of everything.
Yeah, that's super interesting because, like, I think it's kind of like I feel like a problem like you see everywhere, like even in America, not a problem, but like a thing that you see everywhere where, you know, like when you're younger and when you're coming through the ranks, like you're playing a lot of different positions. And I think like from my perspective, and I think from your perspective too, it helps you. Like you become more marketable. You become more of a versatile player that, you know, a coach may see you and want you in that way. And I think that's awesome. Cause I mean, I don't know about striker to center back. That's pretty extreme. That's awesome. It's awesome that you're able to do that. Score 17 Gs, but yeah.
No, that, I mean, yeah, you clearly have a lot of notches on your belt, Vic, and obviously it's helped you. I think it's helped you out. Your versatility, like I was just saying, has made you marketable and obviously made you marketable to all these clubs that you played for, as well as the national team and operating through different levels. And I think it's given you a lot of experience that a lot of people don't have. And I think one thing that I've been wondering is like, In all of these contests, all these club games and all these national team games, you must have come up against some pretty remarkable teams and remarkable players. Is there anyone that like comes to mind that you think of when you're talking about, yeah, I played against him and here he is now?
So if you start off by talking about players, Martin Ødegaard, Arsenal. He was insane. this was the year when he went to Real Madrid. Yeah. So he was like intensely good for his age at the time. And then I played, Ben Woodburn, if you know him. Like at the moment, he's still like a Liverpool player and everything. But at the time, he was like, he played his first game for Liverpool the week after. And he took our right back in that game and absolutely wiped him. I've never seen anything like it.
No. Hopefully he doesn't listen to this.
I hope not. Oh, he's a professional player with the A national team like right now. So I think you'll forgive me.
Yeah, for sure.
But then Donnarumma.
Ooh,
who was actually losing against Argentina right now? We played against him. Our striker in that game scored with his butt against Donnarumma, which is a great story to tell your grandchildren.
That might be the only way to score against him, honestly. So.
It was a clearance. He blocked it with his ass and straight into the goal. It was amazing.
Was he massive at that age too? Was he just a tree amongst humans?
He just looked like he looks now. I'm not kidding you. This was when I was 19, so he would have been 18 at that time.
Yeah.
Wow. And he was just that big. But yeah, that was against Italy. So the best teams I played against was probably the Italy national team. They were amazing. And then we played, I played Man City with Norwich. That was, yeah, unbelievable as well.
Yeah. Just
unbelievable. There was this, there was this 15-year-old kid in the Man City team. He was playing as a 10, and he just signed a contract because he was bought from Real Madrid. And he had, at 15 years old, he had like, it was around £60,000 a month, which is like, was it like $80,000, I think, a month at 15.
Yeah.
Then it was just,
I mean, that's how it is. Like when you get a contract, when you're really highly valued, I think a lot of people in America don't understand that, is that when you are a really good 15-year-old, that becomes your entire life. It's not like, oh, maybe I go pro, maybe I go to college. It's I go pro or I don't really know what I'm doing. And I spent some time in England, and kids were getting contracts at 8 years old over there for some of the top clubs. And I think that's something that people don't understand that over here, that you basically get put into this pipeline where you haven't even reached the age of 18, and you're driving cars, like designer cars, and wearing designer clothes, and you have all this responsibility and all this power at such a young age. And I honestly don't understand. Obviously, it gets to some people's heads, but to the people that it doesn't get to their head, I think it's so impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's overwhelming, man. Like, the week I was at Norwich, it was cutting week. They call it cutting week, which means there were like games, like scrimmages in the team. So it was like they were just playing in bit pennies and stuff. And so the cutting week worked like they played for the weekend some games, and then the coaches went to up to 8 year olds and said, "Hey, you're not good enough. You have to leave." And then to another one, they were like, "You are good enough. You get a new contract." And it's like, it's just so intense. And that's like maybe a kind of a difference between the States and Europe, is that like the plan B, if you're not going pro, you can at least go to college, you know. But here it's like, if you don't go pro, what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Totally. And it's also, I think it's a mindset thing where, and I think it's shifting. I think America's coming along slowly and it's definitely getting there. But also, I don't think you'd see in many places, some places in America you'd see it, but I don't think you'd see in many places coaches tell an 8-year-old they're not good enough.
No.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not. We see participation trophies, but.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's great, Vic. But so you started talking about it, but that transition or that difference, I guess, between playing in Europe versus playing in America. And that's kind of where we want to take it next, because I feel like there's a lot there, and I feel like you can provide a lot of valuable things to anyone, really, just about if you speak on your transition to America from Europe and kind of walk us through that decision for you. And kind of how it's panned out so thus far. And as you kind of wrap up, I guess, your college career here in one fall semester, kind of reflecting on it.
So like, if I just start off, like I just came back from the States here, and it hit me right away what I miss the most about European soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like, no matter how many people are there in the stands, like I went to a game for a third division club in Sweden with 2,000 people in the stands that sang for 4 hours straight. They came there 2 hours before the game and went to the bar and sang the whole time. So that's like a huge factor for me that I miss about it. And like when I played at IA, like we could not go out to a restaurant if we lost the game that week. Like there were just people that came up to us and like, "Hey, you suck." so that's like the intensity of the fan base, because it just becomes a religion, really. Like it's not only the players that live for the game, but it's the fans also that live for the game. About the transition, like soccer wise, One thing is that when you go to college, or like we are doing, like you have school in the morning and then you go to practice and then you do more schoolwork in the evening or even have a night class or something. But like when I was playing in Europe, it was like soccer was number 1, 2, and 3 and everything else came behind. So like now during the summer season, when normally like there are summer vacations and stuff, and the Icelandic and Swedish and Norwegian league, they just started. Mm-hmm. So now if I would be playing in Europe, I would be getting to the training ground at 8:30 in the morning. I would be leaving the training ground at 4.
Yeah.
So like, it's just like you go there and that's your job. You go there, you eat, you go to practice, you come back in, you get lunch. Then you might play ping pong with the guys or whatever, and then it's a meeting, and then you have maybe a lift, and then you go home right before dinner. So like, I think that is a very big factor of it also, is that I'm thankful for it in a sense that I'm able to get a degree while playing, mm-hmm. because that's much harder here. But also like the like atmosphere around just going to the training ground and being there, that is something that is very different. And then the style of play, like you guys all, we've all played together. So we know it's like long balls, physical and stuff like that. And we talk about it in practice, like most goals in college come from less than 2 passes and corners. Like I'm used to the game where like I can have, my team can have the ball for like 8 minutes without losing it. And then just the other team has it for 8 minutes before losing it. So soccer-wise, the transition was that it was more direct and a little less organized in a sense that like I was before coming, I was used to, hey, we had 2 formations and this was all our style of play. And we just, everybody knew how we were going to play and what we were going to do. But it's, I feel like it's more in the States, what I've experienced is that like you go into a game with something and then you just, it's like kind of a figure it out type of thing.
Yeah. Mm. And I also feel like something that plays into that is I think over in Europe, it's everyone has the technical and tactical knowledge and ability. So the tactics, like, this is what we're going to do. We want to put the ball into the space. We want to move the ball. We want to attack this defender. And I think a lot in America, it's like, it's figuring out how to even get there in the first place.
Yeah.
So I think that's also something, it's like a mindset, and maybe that's something that's shifting, but where in Europe, it's, this is what we're going to do. And I think in America, it's a little focused on how we're going to do it still. I mean, would you have anything to offer on that?
I feel like it helps a lot in Iceland, for example, that we have licensed coaches from when you're 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So
right.
So you consistently have coaches that are like have a UEFA degree in coaching. And the fun thing is also, that the academies in the States do this, but like every single youth team connects to the first team. So if the first team has a philosophy of how to play, then the under 21, the under 19, 17, 15, and down to 11, they all have the same philosophy of how are we going to play. And then from when you're 10 years old, you are learning how to exactly play the philosophy and the style of play that you play in the first team. So like, before I played my first-team game in Iceland, I had played that same philosophy for 15 years. So I knew exactly what I was getting into, really.
Yeah, Vic, I was thinking the same exact thing about that, that kind of difference in philosophy that you were just talking about, how like you're at it. Like I was thinking about it when you were talking about like you played Manchester City and a 15-year-old is on the pitch, right? And it was just racing through my mind, like as soon as you said that, just about like how their style of play must have been, you know. And I wonder, just like bringing it back to America, like I wonder going along with that point, if it's almost like there's like a, what am I trying to say? Because there's such like an established philosophy in Europe, and then you have we're just going to take American colleges, for example, where you have a player turnover every year, right? Obviously there's player turnover in Europe, but you're getting new teammates every 6 months, every 8 months, whatever it may be. Also that makes it harder on the coaches, you know, to kind of set that philosophy, set that style of play. In addition, you know, you already mentioned, we are going to class. We're going to class for 4 hours a day. We have, I don't know, in Division I, we have like max, like 3 hours of countable hours a day type thing, you know? So there's less time to work with the players on that philosophy. So do you think that plays into it a little bit?
I definitely think so. I also think what plays into it is that some players in college, they come into college knowing that they're not going to be professionals, if you know what I mean. Like, they are there, they love the game, but they know that, like, oh, I'm getting this degree because I'm going to become a lawyer, you know. But if you do exactly the same in Europe, all the players there are there because they are there for soccer, nothing else. So I think that also plays a part of it. But of course, it's like, if you're always switching teammates and stuff, like, the only way to do it so it would not disturb the team is that you would recruit exactly the players for that exact philosophy all the time.
Exactly.
And just have the same style of play for many, many years. Instead of recruiting players and then choosing how to play based on those players. So you just recruit those players. But yeah, it's all factors in. It's time of the team. It is... how much the team knows each other on the field, because like you can maybe have players that have played 4 years together and they know exactly where each other are the whole time. But then you have six guys that came in like just 6 months ago, and all of a sudden they are supposed to do the same thing, but it's hard when you don't know each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, I think it's something that America is starting to learn. And I think you see it in certain academies across the country. They're starting to develop players that are really young, 16 years old, playing for the first team. Obviously garnering interest from Europe. We're seeing a lot of Americans go over to Europe. And we're also seeing a lot of Europeans come over to America with the Chiellini news. He might sign with LAFC pretty soon. But as someone that has experienced this coming from Europe to America, and to a certain extent, you have some Americanness to you, and you're going back to Europe. What would you tell people listening to this about that? Just culturally, like soccer culturally, how different is it?
I think, now, if I go to practice with a team now, the biggest difference, and I know, like, this, some people might not agree with it, but I think most people I've talked to agree with this, is it's not that necessarily the technical abilities, soccer abilities, that are different. It's not necessarily like that or how hard you work, because in the States you work very hard and like you're physical and everything. I think what is the biggest difference when I go to practice in the States versus practice in Europe is that the every single player I play with in Sweden almost have this such a high soccer IQ. So they don't even need to be in the same shape, because they don't need to run as much, because they just know where to be at the right moment, and they know where to run to open space, and they know where they're supposed to pass it, like, exactly. So I think that is like the biggest part. So you stop following the game all the time, and you start like being more in control of what is happening around you. I think that is probably the biggest difference for me when I go to practice in the States versus Europe.
So Vic, I know you're talking about what you're gonna do after school a little bit, and I know something that you've mentioned is that you want to get into scouting when you're done playing. And obviously, hopefully, you're not done playing anytime soon. hopefully you have a nice illustrious career. But eventually one day you would like to enter the realm of player scouting. And that's something I think you're super fit for, because you've seen so many different leagues, so many different clubs, so many different countries. But talk to us a little bit about that. Firstly, maybe what you've seen firsthand as far as the European scouting databases, how they do it over there. And then secondly, just get into what you would like to do and how you can apply all the knowledge that you've gained throughout your soccer career towards what you think could be a prosperous scouting career as well.
So, like you said, of course, I want to milk my soccer career as long as I possibly can. But as I say, like, as long as you have fun, then why stop? But yeah, there have been many, like, occupations in my head that I'm thinking, oh, should I do this? Should I do this? But it all ends up being something soccer related. It always ends there. And I have my coaching degrees, and I've seen a little bit of firsthand scouting and been helping here and there to see some players and find some players. And like what I've seen firsthand there to begin with is just that as a scout for an agency, for example, you have your players and the best in the business, they choose their clients wisely. And this is what like young players sometimes do not well enough, is that there are two cues in this. It's how is the mentality of the player himself? Is he thinking, hey, I want to be the best player I can, I want to take the right steps? Or is he going to say, hey, oh, can you get me there because I want the money there? Or he's a star before he even shows that he is a star. The mm-hmm. second warning sign you get when you are a scout is if the parent says, oh, so we were thinking about, so can we go to that club? Are we good enough? Instead of talking about the kid, they talk about them. Which means to me, when I look at it, I see it as, oh, the kid is following his parents' dreams, not his. I want to hear his voice. I want to hear what he wants, not the parent. So that is a lot of it. But if you just go into the basics of scouting, it's mostly it starts when you're like 14, 15, maybe 13, 14, 15. And like you may be in some kind of youth national team selection or whatever. And then you just seen. And a good quote that one man said was to me was, if you're good enough, you will get the chance. Mm-hmm. So as a player, you should, for me, I would never contact a scout or an agent and say, hey, right, this is me. Because mm-hmm. if you just show it, you will be good enough. And that is what the scouts have here, is they have such a large database and right, they see so many games that mm-hmm. if you perform, they will be interested in you. Mm-hmm. And then of course, like the other side of it is a club comes to a agent or a scout, scout for an agency or scout for a player. And he comes to that scout and says, hey, I need a player in that position. He needs to be this old and he's going to play that many minutes. So he might have to be willing to be a bench player. And then the scout goes through his documents and just, hey, yeah, okay, this, these are interesting, and sends it over. Mm-hmm. So it's both about recognizing talent and recognizing the fit for the talent. Because the worst thing you can do is recommend the player to go somewhere when it doesn't fit him nor the team.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, that scouting thing is like, I would like to be I thought scouting agent, coach, or like director of football, which like translates to like sports director or something in the States, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anything related to that, where you are involved in the game, is something that I would love to do.
Yeah. Well, touching touched on the scouting part of it. I think it's also super interesting because we've seen a shift in the way that players are being recognized. So I think if you went back 20 years even, you would see a lot of eye tests. But you look at a club like Liverpool, right? They're bringing in Luis Diaz. Who had heard of him before that? They're bringing in guys like Konate, who had heard of him before that. And why are they doing it? Because of these advanced numbers and metrics and programs like Instat, which track basically every single one of your actions. So I think that's super interesting because I think there is a middle ground. And then maybe you can talk on this after, between the numbers and the eye test. So what do you think about that? Because, okay, maybe a player hits all these metrics and then you watch him play a top level game, whether that be youth or professional, and you just don't see it. Or what if you see a player that's absolutely killing it, but he's just not hitting these numbers, this match form that you need. So as a guy that might be a scout one day, and I know you know a few scouts personally, how is that landscape really working right now with the numbers and then obviously just the old-fashioned eye test?
So I actually know about the guy. I've seen the guy that was – he scored 16 literal tap-ins one season. And this one club bought him just for his stats. He just scored 16 goals. It's amazing. He's going to score so many goals. Bought two leagues higher. So he's brought up two leagues or two tiers and hasn't played a minute because he isn't good enough. Mm-hmm. So that thing about the stats, they help a lot. Like what you say to a player when he's thinking, I want to take a next step or something, it is, hey, perform at your club first. Because if a club looks at your report and says, hey, okay, he has this many games, he has this many goals, or this is even his like passing stats or whatever, he looks at that before. But what you were talking about is a middle ground is so, so nice, because what is getting more and more popular is that you go through the stats, or you see something, you see a stat, and then after that, you might like him, and then you send a scout to watch him play. And the funny thing is, sometimes the coaches aren't even, or the scouts aren't even looking at the practice thinking, hey, how does he play? Because they've seen it all in video. It's about how he approaches practice. It's about how he walks onto the field. Does he greet the coaches? Does he have like, is he like overly arrogant, or is he like a good for the team? Is he a good team player? Does he put hard work into practice, or does he only do that in games? That's also another factor. It's mostly when scouts have seen a lot of a player through like videos and stats and stuff, they sometimes just go and look how you act on the field instead of how you play. So that is something that every player should have in mind, is that it's not only about how you play, it's all about how you act and how you like represent yourself.
Yeah, and I think young players, and if there's any listeners that are younger guys trying to get noticed, I think what Vic just said is super important, because you can be the most talented player in the world at any level. Even we see guys every day on college teams, you know, they're really talented guys, but the body language matters too. Being a good teammate first matters too. And obviously at the professional level, there's no room for any kind of bad characters, even if you're banging in the goals, even if you're a great player.
Yeah. And we've all seen it. Like we've all played with those type of players. We've all seen it, and you know, sometimes it works out for them, but most of the time it doesn't. And it is like, as Dylan and Vic are saying, it's like it's a big deal. And yeah,
I can tell you one quote that I was told once. So hard work beats talent if talent doesn't work hard.
Look, yeah, hey, that's a little American quote from you.
It's very popular over here.
I'm getting into the culture, man. I'm getting into
you
the
are.
Culture.
Yeah, no. American.
Man, it's good stuff. So, Vic, I think, are you ready to get a little deep here, Vicky? We have a little bit of a deep question for you.
Yeah, bring it.
So broad, but I want you to take it wherever you feel is best. What does soccer mean to you when it comes down to it? I mean, I know you've talked about you want to stay around the game all your life. You're a soccer junkie, right? But what does soccer mean to you, and what has it done for your life, if you could put it into words?
So just to start this off, my biggest pet peeve is when people say it's just a game. Yeah, because it
too.
Isn't.
Me too. It's so much more than a game. Yeah.
It's so much more than a game. Though some people might look at it and say, hey, it's just a game, it's something that people live for everywhere around the world. And for me, like, since I was young, like, so I was a difficult child to raise, like a difficult child, like ADHD on a next level kind of kid. So my mom, what she did was after my kindergarten or school day, we went to the soccer field and were there for 2 hours just for me to blow off steam. And that kept my sanity when I came back home, because like then I blew off steam and I actually like got a little tired, so I was able to calm down. And so the soccer field for me has always been like my happy place. No matter what it is, no matter what's happening in life, no matter how my day went, where I feel the best is at the soccer field. So that has always been like, and I'll tell you right now, I don't know where I would be in life if I had not played soccer all my life. Because like, in a sense, it characterizes me and it's a part of my personality. And like will always be, like it's just a part of me. And to get that in a broader sense, you see people all around the world, 80,000 people come to a stadium to cheer for a soccer game, and that's not because it's a game, that's because there's passion for it. It's right. It's something that people get excited for, people live for. So that's the thing. It's, if I should just say it in like a short term here, it's like a short phrase, is it's not just a game, it becomes a part of you and a part of your characteristics and personality. So like when people say like, oh, I'm a Virgo or whatever, you know, oh, that's a part of me. Oh, this is my date of birth. It's the same with soccer for me. It just becomes, when you ask, oh, yeah, I play soccer, I like soccer, it's just a part of my personality.
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, I think playing any sport, not just soccer, also builds a lot of your character, not only in the successes, but in the failures. And obviously for you, it's just been a pivotal part of your life. And I also think it's really cool that it's taken you to so many different countries, now a different continent. I mean, I can only imagine the number of people that you've met and the relationships you've made. And so I'm happy you play soccer, because it took you here to Villanova, and we got to get to know each other. So
yeah, for sure.
Exactly. But, we would not have met if it wasn't for soccer.
Yeah.
Think about that fact.
Exactly. And I feel like it's something, like, that's why I love that question, because I feel like it's something that like you don't even realize or think about enough, right? Like for me, like I never think about how much soccer has influenced my life and been a part of my life, you know, like you don't really step back enough, you know. And it is like, it's such a great thing. And like, you know, that's why we're all scared of what comes next after soccer, because it is such a big part of our lives, right?
Exactly. Like it's like for me, like that question, it's just been brought up so many times of like, what are you going to do after soccer? And like, do you know what you're going to do with yourself? It is in a similar way of like finishing an amazing TV show, like the last season of an amazing TV show. And you're like, sit there after the episode and like, I don't know what to do with my life now. Yeah. like, it's the same thing. Like,
well,
then you
I'll
always end up
you,
watching another TV show. But
I will tell you one thing. There's one person, one very big player, who does know what they're gonna do after they're done playing soccer, and we will get into that as we move on to our biggest winners and biggest losers. So, for the audience, for the listeners, basically, what we want to do here is just talk about things that have gone really well in the soccer world and things that have not gone so well. So we're going to have a biggest winner of the week and a biggest loser of the week. And so, Drax, you want to start off?
Yeah. No, this is tough. I mean, there's a lot going on in the soccer world, but, you know, I guess this is a little bit of the American part of me that kind of drove this decision maybe a little bit. But my biggest winner of the week is Leeds United. I think, you know, their backs were against the wall, right, for relegation. And they needed help from Burnley. And, you know, they did their job and they did it well. And not to mention the scenes after that game was impeccable. I think that's why it stuck with me a little bit. But, you know, happy for Jesse Marsh, happy for that club for staying up. And, you know, I'm just excited to watch them in the Premier League next year. And I think it was a massive feat for them. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I
think the thing about I'll start off a little bit. So Leeds United, the thing is that it's so important that they are in the Premier League, because what people don't realize that haven't watched soccer for that long is that this is a historic club.
It's a huge club. It's a huge, like, it's one of the biggest clubs in England. It's one of the biggest clubs in England.
The fan base of that club is insane.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's the same reason that I'm really excited just as a fan of the sport to see Newcastle do well, because these are just big clubs with massive followings that are part of the culture of soccer in these countries.
Right.
No, I totally agree. And also, like you said, as an American, all the Ted Lasso jokes about Jesse Marsh. It's good to see him do well, because he's obviously catching a lot of heat. I don't know how much of it is deserved or not, but he did a job keeping him up. And another American joining now in Aronson. So, yeah, I think it's a good time for the club, big for them to stay up. That kind of ties into my winner. My biggest winner of the week is Pitch Invasions. One of my fondest memories of the game is Troy Deeney scoring a winner to take Watford to the playoff final. In every sport, it's just my favorite sporting moment ever. I was fortunate enough to be at the time, fifth division club Barnet when we went up to the fourth division, and I was able to partake in a pitch invasion. And to anyone, which is probably a lot of people that hasn't been part of it, it's really one of the most exhilarating things anyone can ever experience. But obviously you see a lot of these pitch invasions for winning a league, as we saw at City, and that's awesome. The scenes are great. It's great to see the community. But the reason that it's my winner is because there's been a ton of pitch invasions, both for league winning and trophy winning performances, but also we've been seeing them for clubs that have been staying up, which is super awesome to me. Obviously we saw Everton, and what scenes there were there. Some of the most brilliant scenes of the season for them staying up. And then you go over to Germany, and I believe it was Stuttgart scoring in the 92nd minute. And if I recommend to anyone just to watch that clip on YouTube, I mean, it'll give you chills. So just seeing that all over the sport, obviously we're getting out of a pandemic where fans have not been allowed in stadiums. And we all saw how much that just affected the game and the spirit of the game, and it just wasn't the same. So having fans back in stadiums, seeing these moments where, you know, as we talked about, it's more than a game, right? And you see that in these pitch invasions, you see how much it means to these people. And it's just been so wholesome, so awesome to see, even if you don't support the club. Look up the Everton clip, look up the Stuttgart clip, and it'll remind you and it'll show you how much more than a game soccer is. So that's my winner of the week. What about you, Vic?
So my winner of the week, and this is maybe obvious, maybe it's boring, but it's Thibaut Courtois. The guy, so like in his Champions League final game, and I hate to say this because I'm a Liverpool fan, but he was unbelievable. And he showed exactly why Real Madrid wanted him so bad from Chelsea. Yeah. So that is for me, like it's a simple one. It might be a boring one, but like he has to get a shout here because unbelievable performance from him.
Yeah,
totally.
And what are you saying?
Go ahead, Drax.
I was just going to say, and he'll tell you he's being disrespected too, and his performance and his greatness isn't being respected. So it's a good mention for sure. That's a good one. Yeah, and then my biggest loser, this was tough, but I think my biggest loser is Borussia Dortmund. And the reason I'm going with that is because the obvious reason, losing Erling Haaland, losing the Wonder Kid, losing the biggest striker buzzword going around is obviously going to be a massive hit for the club. But another reason is I'm just worried about them. I see Bayern getting stronger. You see the Mane rumors. You see these things, and I'm worried about Dortmund. Like they always have these young players coming out of the woodwork, right? That's how they make their name. But I'm worried. Jude's contract's up in a year. Where will he go? Will he stay? There's just a lot of uncertainty surrounding Dortmund, and I'm worried about them. I want to see them contend for the Bundesliga title, but I don't know if next year is the year. I think there's a lot going on. So
yeah, and it's tough because I almost feel like the gap between them and Bayern Munich has actually been growing since Lewandowski left. Mm-hmm. I think when there was Lewandowski and before Royce was dealing with all his injuries, they were pretty comparable. And obviously, they're probably still the second top dog over there in the Bundesliga. But you do see the gap growing. You do see Haaland leaving and Mane going to Bayern, as you mentioned, drags. And it's just kind of getting to a point with Dortmund where it's like, are they ever going to do it? And I think you're right. Like, I think everybody's kind of rooting for him just a little bit, pulling for them just to see a shift in the dominance of that league. But it's tough.
Mm-hmm. I think also a loser in that example is just Bundesliga.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Because like, it's so boring to watch a league where the same team wins all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You as a City fan, you can also just leave the room, please.
Yeah,
I'm gonna hide that.
Give us the title. No, but that's the Bundesliga. Also, it's like, of course you want Bayern to be Bayern, like they are the giant, you know. But right. You have to have challengers.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I think it was really nice and refreshing to see someone besides Juventus win the Scudetto. Like mm-hmm. I think that's great. And now obviously AC won it this year, so. I think that's awesome, and kind of just agreeing with what you just said, Vic. My biggest loser, which is what I was alluding to earlier, is PSG and the contract and roles that they've given Kylian Mbappe. Because it's just ridiculous. So I just don't think there's a lot of integrity in it. So basically, for those of you that don't know, they gave Mbappe a ton of money, which is fully deserved. He's one of the best players in the world. But he's also now going to decide the head coach, the sporting director, and transfers. So he's also going to be the general manager of the team, essentially. I mean, we're talking about this guy being the second highest ranking person in the club besides the owner himself. And this is not calling Mbappe a loser. This isn't any hate towards him. He's one of the brightest young talents in the world, and he's awesome, and I think we're all fans. But on the club's front, what are you doing? You can't give a guy that's in his early 20s all this power. I mean, it's just, this has never been done, and it's never been done for a reason, because it's just not right. I mean, there's a hierarchy to clubs. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo isn't given this. Lionel Messi isn't given this. Listen, players can talk about who they want in and out in private to the coach, to the sporting director. I think that's totally okay. But to come out and basically make this public information that this guy is going to decide the squad, and not only the squad, the guy who will be coaching them and the guy who will be bringing in players, I think it's ludicrous. And I don't really know what to say about it, but I think it's the biggest loser of the week for me, because I don't think it should ever get that far, no matter how bad you want a player.
I started thinking about this, and like, is Mbappe just going to fire and hire coaches how he wants? And like, is he going to have the tactical meeting before game? Like, what is going to happen? Because like the dude now, like he literally controls the second most in the club. Like he has a role in the club that like you should not have as a player.
Yeah. Let me add something too. When I heard this news and when I saw this contract, the one thing I don't, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but the one thing I don't like about the NBA in today's day and age is that the players have a lot of control about bringing these super teams together and all this stuff. And that's something I don't want leaking into the soccer world at all. Like, and that's my biggest worry with this. And it's like, I agree with you completely, Dylan. It's a big deal and a big loser of the week for sure.
It's just not right. No. I just feel like it's just not right. What about you, Vicky?
This one, it relates to soccer, but it's not completely soccer. Is the police and the security at Stade de France in the Champions League game?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable that at this stage, a Champions League final game, that this is happening. Like, were they expecting 20,000 people to come, or did they expect people to come in like sections? Or like, of course people are going to arrive 2 hours before the game, which is normal, and then you're going to have traffic, so deal with it. And to hear even Andy Robertson said that he gave some friends of his tickets and they were not able to get in because the security told them they had false, like fake tickets.
Yeah.
They literally got them from a player that's playing in the game.
Yeah.
Pull up your pants and get your stuff straight, man.
No, Dick, it's just disgraceful.
Literally just think about the players having to deal with a 30-minute delay of the biggest game of their life. Like, I can't imagine. Like, I've played in big games. We all have throughout our lives, right? And you know the game, you do your pregame rituals, right? You eat what you need at what time. And now you have to wait 30 minutes to get on the field and do it. It's just, it's ridiculous, to be honest. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
And then on top of all of this, the way that UEFA handled it, the message they put on the board that, oh, the game's late because fans are showing up late. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Fans are showing up late to the Champions League final. I mean, this game is supposed to be a celebration of, you know, the biggest European tournament with supposedly like the best two clubs in the final. And it's tainted. It was totally tainted. And one thing I'll add, watching the broadcast on Paramount Plus, Liverpool is obviously a club that has dealt with the tragedy of, you know, that happened. And you could see Jamie Carragher visibly distressed. I mean, this is a club with supporters that have trauma with this kind of thing. And then obviously we know what happened there. It came out years later that, of course, you know, it was the fans' fault, and I just think it was really just upsetting to see such a beautiful celebration just get a little tainted by unprofessionalism. And then UEFA trying to put it, you know, take the blame off them. It really
just at least if you're UEFA, say, hey, we messed up. We are sorry. We apologize. Yeah. At least do that. Don't be blaming the fans.
Exactly.
That's insane. Exactly. And yeah, but I also want to add like an extra loser just here in case. I wanted to add a little extra, a little spice.
Anything for you, Vicky.
I want to put this loser on both. I don't want to say the artist. I want to say UEFA for hiring Camila Cabello to play a set before the game. Do you really think that drunk Liverpool supporters from the hardworking city of Liverpool came there to watch someone sing before the game? Like, I love the Super Bowl. I love the halftime show. But when it comes to soccer, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Nope. Like, and if you've seen, like, have you seen the broadcast version versus real life version? No, nobody heard her singing at the stadium because the fans just over chanted her, both Real Madrid and Liverpool. You can't hear a word she's singing. That's hilarious.
I didn't even know that.
That's why I don't want to say that she is a loser at all, because she was hired to do this.
Right.
But I also felt bad for her because she come in there doing her best, and it's just a mistake by UEFA, really, to have done that, because none of these fans were there to listen to a concert. They were all there for the game.
Yeah. And that was on top of the delay too. So it was 30 minutes delay, and then it was her performing. Honestly, just shambolic performance by UEFA.
Performing while fans are being pepper sprayed.
Yeah, yeah.
Maced outside the stadium.
I know. Mm-hmm. It's
unbelievable. Ridiculous.
But anyways, our last segment that we're going to do today is going to be Spin the Wheel. And so what this is going to be is, let's say you are at a game with a 30-minute delay because the UEFA is not handling it correctly, and you're sitting next to a fan, and you got to talk to them about one of the top five leagues. So we're going to spin the wheel. We have no idea what's going to come up, and we're going to say something very interesting that's going on in that league. And so let's see what we get. All right, lads, Serie A, talk to me.
Ooh, I got first. Give me it. Tap me in. Wait, so it's speaking to a fan, correct?
Yeah, fan, okay. Friend, elevator pitch.
Yeah, all right. how about Zlatan, man? And this guy is just a tank. I mean, winning the Sassuolo, no ACL for half the season. What about that? This guy is literally not human. Literally not human. And I love, give me more of him saying he's not human, because he's actually not human.
And I don't know if you saw, he posted the video of him draining his knee.
Yeah.
I saw. It was really gross, but he was doing it once a week, and he has, like you said, he's not a human. He's crazy.
Yeah.
He is loved here in Sweden where I live.
Yeah.
He is loved. But the other thing about him here is, how about Zlatan by walking out to the field with a cigar and a champagne bottle like an absolute king with no ACL, just won the league. Amazing. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And shout out MLS, because he came to the MLS. Everyone said he was done. Everyone, over in Europe or wherever it was, that doesn't say the MLS is a great league. And he came back and he kept his form. He performed similarly. Obviously, probably had more goals over here in the MLS, but he kept his career going. And I know he took it personally when people said he was done for going to the MLS, and he mentioned that. And I think the MLS is a little winner in that whole situation as well.
I'm also going to mention, I hope, really, really hope that he decides not to retire. But I'm afraid he will, since the sad passing of Mino Raiola. I have a feeling that he will retire, but if he does, then thank you for everything, Zlatan, because you are unbelievable.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is all for this week's episode, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to hit that subscribe button on our page and download this episode. Also, be sure to check out Around the World on YouTube. The link will be in the description of this podcast. Again, thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week on Around the World.